We would like to begin this podcast by acknowledging that the land on which we record is the occupied, traditional, and unceded territory of the Stalo First Nation.
Whether you think of yourself as a conservationist or someone who has any kind of interaction with the rest of the creative world, we all eat, and every time we eat, every food decision we make is a decision to be hospitable or not to the rest of the world. So in our cooking, in the things we eat, the way we cook them, the way we discard the packaging, how much we eat, what we share of it, all of that is a profoundly creational activity. And therefore, it belongs in this picture of caring for creation.
Welcome to the Ending Poverty Together podcast. I'm Shalane, and we're here to discuss big questions about poverty in bite-sized ways. Joe Swinney is Director of Communications for Arasha International and a multi-award-winning author with her 9th book out this fall. She has an MA in Interdisciplinary Theology from Regent College in Vancouver, BC, and now lives in Bath, UK, with her husband and 2 daughters. Jo grew up in Portugal, where her parents set up the first Arasha project, and she subsequently lived in Zimbabwe, France, and Canada. She loves nothing better than cooking up a storm for friends and family and getting stuck in deep conversation and story sharing over food. Jo, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's a delight to be able to have this conversation. And I'm wondering if we could just start by perhaps you telling me a little bit, we could talk a little bit about Arasha, because I'm wondering if some of our listeners are maybe not familiar with Arasha and with the work that is done there.
Yeah, of course. Arasha, to begin with, the word means the rock in Portuguese, and it was founded in 1983. I was a child, and our family moved to Portugal because at that point, the church was largely absent from any care of creation, any environmental sphere, and already things were beginning to tip in a bad direction for biodiversity, for habitat, species, the climate. Not very much attention giving to that, but some scientists definitely sounding out some warning. And my parents had the conviction that God cares very deeply what happens to all that he's made, not just the human part. So we moved off to Portugal. They started a field study center and began trying to protect a small area of wetland, small but very significant because it's on a major migration route from North Africa to Europe. So all these little birds need somewhere to rest their legs and feed up for a while on their long journeys. And a lot of the southern stretch of Portugal, the Algarve, even more so now, but was being covered in golf courses and marinas and hotels.
Oh.
Yeah. So it started really small. It was small for about 12 years and it's now in 20 plus countries. We're growing all the time. 6 continents, very different expressions of what it looks like in those different places. But we have 5 core commitments. We're Christians doing conservation. We believe in cultural diversity and community and collaboration.
I am familiar with the Arasha that's actually not very far from where our national office is located, the one that is in British Columbia, or one of the ones in British Columbia in the Lower Mainland. And familiar with some of the conservation work that's being done there with the salmon, and just have a really strong appreciation for the community aspect that Arasha brings. I can imagine someone listening to this podcast thinking, this is a podcast on poverty. What are you doing talking about creation? How does poverty and creation come together?
It's a matter of our interdependence. Everyone who lives in this world relies on the soil and the water and the air. And when those things are depleted, polluted, overused, mistreated, it's the poor who suffer first and worst. They're the ones who will have the toxins in their lungs and lack the ability to have air filters. They're the ones whose food sources will be immediately cut when the rains don't come or a pest flourishes because its predator has been made extinct. The people with financial reserves can buy their way out of trouble for a while longer. The poor among us are the most vulnerable to all of these consequences.
Mm-hmm. At Food for the Hungry, we often talk about God intending us to be in four key relationships with Him, with ourselves, with others, and with creation. And when those relationships are broken, that's when poverty exists. That's the root cause of poverty. So the overlap here is very evident. Would you be willing to expand a little bit more on how you see Arasha bridging the worlds of Christian faith and environmental conservation? And maybe just expand a little bit on how you see that connection with that broken relationship that we have with creation.
Yeah, I love that you frame poverty in that way. And I think so much of our issues come back to broken relationship or a misunderstanding of the fact that those dynamics are relational. They're not they're not just a kind of transaction with a non-being. And in terms of the Christian piece of why we are in conservation, I think first and foremost, it's reframing the relationship of God and creation, that He didn't make it as a backdrop for the one thing He cared about, us people. The minute you start reading the Bible to pay attention to that wider dynamic, it's everywhere. The delight that God has in all He's made, the expression that it reflects back of who He is, the fact it praises Him just by being what it was made to be, and the long-term hope for it, along with us, to be redeemed and restored and present in what is to come. I think in every part of the environmentalism world, anyone who is working to care for the place around them in any way is doing it from some kind of belief about why that matters and why they should be doing it. And all we're doing is, that's different, is doing it from a different motivation. And I think ultimately the motivation is worship and love. And that is a far more enticing and invigorating motivator than fear or guilt or self-interest in the long run.
We actually had a staff retreat day at the Arasha Center that's close by us. And I have to be honest, I went in thinking that we were going to come out with tips and tricks on how to care for the environment. And what I actually came out with was, do you embrace wonder? And that, I want to tell you, has profoundly impacted particularly my relationship with our grandchildren, because I am working to instill wonder over the created world with them. So thank you in a broad sense to Arasha for that and for the impact that's having. What would you say to that? How do you respond when you hear that?
Well, the first thought I had was that it's an unusual way around. My experience is it's children who help instill wonder in the adults around them. Because I think we're...
And that's right.
I think we're born with it and we gradually lose it. And so I'm interested that you're taking the lead on that with your grandchildren.
Well, and, you know, in fairness, maybe I'm taking time to participate in wonder with them and putting us in situations where there's more opportunity for that.
Yeah.
But you're absolutely right. They see things that I for sure don't.
I remember when my girls were very small, that it was a kind of, I don't know, a form of spiritual discipline for me to allow them to stop when they saw something interesting, and to try and stop and enjoy it with them. And we were late to a lot of things as a result, because there's a lot of things to see. And they would like pick up a snail and have a chat with it. And there'd be a leaf of an unusual color and they'd need to collect it. And quite often I'd arrive where I was with my hand just absolutely jammed full of random bits and pieces of twig and things. But I think I got into the habit of doing that when they were little. And one of them commented to me the other day that they found it funny that I don't seem to be able to walk past anything without having a smell of it or a feel of it or making some kind of commentary. So I think it's they're getting their comeuppance. I'm the one slowing them down now.
Well, I wonder if they're aware that how much they taught you that. And like you said, that who's teaching who, right? Who's inviting who into that place of wonder?
Yeah. In terms of what you got from the retreat, I'm not at all surprised. I absolutely love Arosha Canada and the Brooksdale Centre for anyone to have an opportunity to go there. It's just a very joyful place and it's somehow so whole. They have a farm and then they feast and there's music and conversation and these beautiful giant trees and people busy, I don't know what they do, getting very muddy and looking at tiny creatures and...
Yes.
But it's a life that makes, I don't know, it reminds me of, it makes me want to be part of it and to dive in. And yeah, if anyone is remotely close by and wants to go and experience it, it's just a beautiful embodiment of everything this organization hopes to be.
Mm-hmm. And one of the things that you just touched on there that I would like to spend a little bit more time on is that the connection between creation, care, community, hospitality, how do you see those fitting and intertwined?
There's a few ways. I think initially the fact that community is part of the package of our commitments is partly because the inspiration for Arosha came about at a regular bird observatory, so no religious dimension to it at all. But my mum and dad, my parents were there, and my dad has always loved bird watching, and they'd all these people would be out on the cliffs or watching birds, and then they'd come back over an evening meal and share what they'd seen and get each other more and more excited. And there was a natural community forming over this love of the birds in that area.
Mm-hmm.
So plus the fact my mum absolutely loved cooking and drawing people together, maybe not so much into the science and the birds, but a really amazing hostess. And then the fact that it can be very lonely and difficult when you are spending your life maybe with just a handful of specific creatures or species, trying to advocate for them in the face of a lot of other interests, often seeing them not do terribly well. So to do this work in the company and presence of others is really important. Then there's the other part of it, which is that whether you think of yourself as a conservationist or someone who has any kind of interaction with the rest of the creative world, we all eat, and every time we eat, every food decision we make is a decision to be hospitable or not to the rest of the world. So in our cooking, in our the things we eat, the way we cook them, the way we discard the packaging, how much we eat, what we share of it, all of that is a profoundly creational activity. And therefore it belongs in this picture of caring for creation.
Thank you. I know you have written several books, and your latest book sounds like it perhaps touches on this quite a bit. It's called A Place at the Table, Faith, Hope, and Hospitality. I understand that book came about in some unusual and quite painful circumstances. And I'm wondering if you would be willing to share a little bit about that and why you wrote the book.
You maybe caught me changing tenses when I spoke about my mum. And that's because 5 years ago, which is a weirdly short and long time, she was killed in a car accident. And...
Oh, I'm so sorry.
Thank you. So up until that time, for years, she had been talking about writing a book on hospitality and community. And she hadn't got a completed manuscript or anything like, and I had started to get a bit impatient with all the talk and sort of ended up saying, look, it's never going to be a good time. Just write the thing or stop talking about it.
So that sounds like a daughter thing to say.
So she stopped talking to me about it anyway. We were then clearing out her study and off moving my dad to a smaller house near us as a family. And we found a folder where she'd gathered all this material she'd been working on. And it was a really reasonable start. It wasn't a whole book, but it was enough. It was enough for me to take and then work around it to create the book. So it's exactly half written by her and half by me. Some of it's drawn from the book she was thought she was writing. And then quite a good proportion of it is from her journals, where I was looking for specifically parts she was talking about, community, food, hospitality, and how those themes kind of tie into the care of creation.
Would you be willing to share some of the stories or a couple of the stories from her journals? I think that would be fascinating to hear.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, she was such a trooper. So one of the things I realized in reading the journals was just quite how rough and ready and difficult it was when we first moved to Portugal. So that was in the early 1980s. And Portugal had come out of a period of really repressive politics. It was still a situation where people were using donkey carts for transportation and electricity would come and go. And the roads were kind of unpaved a lot of the time. The houses had leaky roofs and things like that. And we moved into this ramshackle farmhouse on an estuary. So it was a headland with marshland all around. And when we first moved in, the water was brown. It was pretty basic, a real adventure for me as a child. But as soon as we were there, people started to show up on the doorstep. And there's so many stories. One that came straight to mind was a Christmas Eve when there was a banging on the door. It was tipping down with rain and a pregnant couple from Israel arrived. And they
on Christmas Eve.
On Christmas Eve. They were expecting a son, as it turned out.
Oh, yes. Interesting.
And they had driven their van right down into the marshes by accident and got stuck. And
oh no.
So they had nowhere to go. So they came.
Did you have room in your inn?
We made room at the inn and they joined us for Christmas. And later she had a gorgeous little baby boy. So that's.
Oh my goodness.
That's one story. Another story would be a time. So there were often a kind of combination of people there, from students studying a particular thing for a university course to volunteers. Sometimes groups would come to do a kind of week away retreat type thing. Sometimes we had usually four or five longer term staff living there. So the house was actually not enormous. I've been back as an adult and my eyes have been slightly on stalks wondering where everybody slept. But this one time we'd all decided there was a meteor shower. So we'd gone and slept on the beach and overnight so that we could watch this meteor shower. And as we were driving back the following morning, this whole massive kind of van load of people overtook us and then were there when we got back, and unexpected, I think. And people who were supposed to leave that day were still all fast asleep. And yeah, just quite a lot of these scenarios where there's just suddenly a lot of people. And my mum would sort of smile and put the kettle on and get her head around it somehow.
Yes. And then be hospitable.
Yeah.
And feed them and house them. Wow, that is a beautiful gift. And in the context of this environment where they're struggling to save the environment, to save the natural habitat, and then the coming together of all of these people. I would imagine that there was probably some educating that happened around the table as well about the work that was being done. Do you remember that as a child? Do you remember those kind of conversations?
I do remember being in kind of the mode of, even as a small child, trying to defend and explain why Christians would give any of their effort to something that wasn't core, in other people's terms, core gospel activity of preaching to unsaved people. So I remember having versions of that said to me, even as a child or around a table, things like, how many birds have you converted then? Or isn't this all going to burn up? Or that, even kind of implying they were a dangerous distraction, or into the new age, or like worshipping creation rather than the creator. That kind of thing was often bandied around. And so I do remember having to come, they had to come for some people from quite a long way back. But they were also a very amazing home for people who in their bones knew it mattered and loved the outdoors, or loved birds or moths, or and also loved God, and would suddenly realize that these two things absolutely belong together and that they weren't alone in feeling that. So the people who found us from that kind of place were just transformed by it. And it was a gathering force as well, because as things have gone on, I think people, as we've done more damage and we've consumed more and more unevenly around the world, but I think there's less now of that kind of pushback. It's probably now a bit more like, oh, it's too late. What's the point? We'll have to wait for God to save it now. It might be more that kind of, it's all too big for us, rather than what's the point? There's no need.
Right. How do you respond to people who are feeling hopeless about the state of creation at this point?
I remember my dad saying to me when I was really quite young that we do the right thing, not because it's going to change the world or necessarily change anything, but because it's the right thing. So I feel that first and foremost, it's us before God making the small choices, because that's the right thing to do in relationship with God. It's worship. Secondly, there's a concept I've come across recently which works really beautifully as a metaphor, but it actually is truthful in reality, which is called refugia. And it's this phenomenon of a small, tiny, surviving part of an ecosystem or a place is enough to propagate a whole area. So where they first identified this was, I think, Mount St. Helens. There was a big earthquake, whole top of the mountain seemingly turned into rubble. But in tiny crevices, there was enough left that when it was safe to go back and people thought they were going to have to, you know, replant and reintroduce things, it was doing very well. It had bounced back.
I've actually seen that.
Have you?
I have.
Oh, wow.
I have hiked on Mount St. Helens, and I've seen the before and the after. I've seen pictures of where things have started to grow back, actually in the shape of an animal that died under the ash. And then the nutrients caused life to grow in that general pattern. There's some incredible stories. It's an absolutely beautiful place.
Oh my goodness. Yes. Wow. I didn't know that.
Yes.
So that is, that really
anyway,
adds...
sorry, I distract.
No, that adds another layer of beauty to it, because it's even death that is made a source of new life. And that obviously is very spot on in certain other stories. But I feel that gives me hope in the small scale obedience or small scale tending of places, even if we have only access to a front yard or whatever our realm of influence is. it's not wasted. Mm-hmm. And as soon as we, I really do feel that as soon as we stop actively harming the world, it will probably recover pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
And I also take great comfort in God's mercy. I feel that he's probably already protected us from the worst consequences of our own sin in this regard. And I just don't think he's going to let the whole thing go.
And that, once again, comes back to where does our hope lie? And I appreciate you making very clear that our hope is in God and the systems that he has created, the way that he has created our environment to rebound, to recover, and also that does not remove our responsibility, that we need to do the right thing because it's the right thing.
I think it's true with extreme human poverty too, that a very small injection of resource and the ingenuity and hard work of people and communities and individuals can pull themselves and future generations out of poverty into a different freedom of living. And it's the same with land and with populations of creatures. So there's no doubt we're not in a great situation. And climate change, I know, has done terrible things for the poverty relief that we achieved even in the recent history. But, you know, we've turned things around in many arenas before, and I have no doubt that with God's help, we will again.
I'm reminded of the founder of Food for the Hungry, who said, people are dying one at a time. They can be saved one at a time. And it feels to me like a similar message that you're sharing, that even the smallest microorganism or part of an ecosystem, if that piece can be saved, the impact can be so widespread.
Yeah, absolutely.
Our time is coming to an end. If you were to summarize, if you were to give kind of a concluding remark, what would you want to say about creation care and faith and hospitality?
Until fairly recently, I thought creation care was for people who were scientists or pretty hardcore, kind of outdoorsy, hiking, don't mind getting muddy people. I think what I've come to realize is that there's a place and a need for absolutely everybody, that it needs the artists and the storytellers, it needs the cooks, it needs the bankers, it needs the farmers. Everybody is needed at this point to care for and restore and recover the situation for the whole planet. And so I would just encourage anyone listening that to see that we're all implicated because we're all in relationship with both the creator and the creation. And secondly, that who you are, who you bring to this effort is very important. And in whatever regard that is, small scale is absolutely powerful as much as the large scale. So, and there's a lot of joy in doing the right thing and doing it alongside others. So I would encourage you to get stuck in, do it with wonder and joy and other people.
Thank you so much, Jo. Really appreciate you taking time to have this conversation. I am inspired and encouraged once again to be caring for creation.
Thank you for having me. It's been a real pleasure.
To explore what your next steps could be, or to find out more about FH Canada and Arasha International, start by checking out fhcanada.org/resources.